This is H, New Orleans, Friday, January 9, 2009. It's 1800 hours. Well, we've had an interesting day, as they say, or several days, or eons. So we join Pliskin in the Dorado Street apartment. Pliskin, I shall refer to it only by its code name. It gets pissed off when I try to attribute a gender to it. Pliskin will send us through a portal in time, where we may find a chronometer, which does what it says on the box. It measures time very precisely, precise enough to coordinate actions across several dimensions. We few, we lucky sons of bitches, will go and get it. So, we've got dressed in civilian skivvies, businessman-like. You know, the kind of businessmen that carry 9mm semi-automatics in their armpits and wear body armor under their shirts. Inconspicuous. If you move in the circles of the New York mob, that is. There's a bit of an issue with interdimensional travel. Frost still has the hand of Tindlis on his back. Pliskin assures us that this will no longer be an issue, though. Frost insists on carrying his eldest sign engraved shotgun, however. We make him wear a raincoat. A size too big for him. I thought about giving him one of Chief's, but that would have been ridiculous. He could have hidden a Barrett Model 50 under there and still look scrawny. Pliskin opens the gate, and we step through. We emerged in a ruined, shelled, bombed, and then shelled again city, with the sound of gunfire in the distance. There were some street names I kind of recognized, and pretty soon I realized where we were. We were in Berlin, Germany. Given its bombed-out state and lack of either all-out quad or continuous all-out fighting, I figured it had to be the tail end or the aftermath of the Battle for Berlin, which would make it late April or early May, 1945. Yeah, bit of a head spinner. But either way, the Americans were not supposed to be here. We looked around, slightly clueless as to what to do next. You know, Pliskin, you should really read the Freedom of Information Act and be a bit more liberal with your information. Then we heard a motor vehicle approach, and we hid, naturally. And we were surprised when we saw a good old Willie's Jeep amble through the rubble, all olive drab with a big white star painted on the hood. The passengers seemed a bit odd. Two men, one woman. The men wore U.S. Army officers' uniforms. There was a sergeant driving and what looked like to be a captain. And he was one massive guy, 6'6" at least and 250 pounds, if an ounce. And he looked like a heavyweight fighter, you know, all muscle. The third passenger was a woman, a dame, as they used to say in that time period. She looked like Lauren Bacall. Jacket, skirt, high heels, big purse. You know, the kind that could easily conceal a small hand cannon? And she was wearing a jaunty beret. The jeep passed us by and came to a stop a bit further on, where a collapsed building had blocked the road. The big one and the dame got out. There was a bit of a discussion, which we couldn't quite hear. Then the jeep did a 180 and drove off. For lack of a better option, I figured it was no coincidence that we, a bunch of Americans, having no business in this time and place, ran into other Americans who had no business being in this time and place. So we followed them, as discreetly as we can manage, which is to say, not too much, given that we had Chief with us. They entered what, judging by the sign above the door, seemed to be a hotel and inn. The building was relatively unscathed, and we approached it cautiously. Believing we had gone unnoticed, we tried to slip in the door, more to get out of the open than any other reason. And we ended up in a cute Mexican standoff. Yeah, we'd be made. The big guy was pointing a big 45 semi-auto at us, and the dame was holding a Mauser broom handle. You know, that's a gun for business, not for show. We, in return, pointed our 21st century 9mm guns. The usual exchanges ensued, but in the end, we were all friends. I'd overheard the dame and the big one chatting. She referred to him as Camp and Joe, so I supposed that his name was Joe Camp, and he confirmed that. I had heard him call her Susan, so I surmised her name was Susan. She declined to confirm. I got the impression that Captain Joe and Susan the Dame and ourselves were not all that different, if one discounts the 60 years that separated us. Special ops they were, perhaps OSS. A godsend, too, because they were going where, it would seem, we needed to go. A place where a chronometer was to be had. I'd overheard them earlier, and they seemed to have had a bit of an argument about something called an angle web, which a certain Jones had used earlier. Apparently they were not certain about it and kept talking about an entrance in this inn, an entrance that Jones had learned about from someone called Von Torremath. They were having their doubts about this Von Torremath fellow. Anyway, the discussion ended right soon as we descended into the cellar. After moving a few barrels, we located a hidden door. No, the locks of ancient hidden doors do not resist bullets all that well. And a winding staircase beneath, which led us to a cash box labeled Children's Fund, or rather a cellar with an elaborate pattern. To my eye, it seemed to shimmer and shift. You know, kind of like watching a 3D movie without the glasses. Susan seemed to know what she was doing, tracing certain parts of the pattern. The cellar kind of narrowed. Walls seemed to be closing in, shifting colors, turning red, rippling, and closing in on us, until we had our backs to the wall, and the other wall had become a heavy red curtain. We could hear music, and a whole bunch of voices, all speaking German. We, that is, everybody except Captain Joe and Susan the Dame, were a bit wary. No Habekraut, or so we thought. As we stepped beyond the curtain, we saw a huge room, laid out as a bar, an upscale one with walkways leading to balconies with private tables, and a massive bar tended by a single barman, all in black. Not dressed in black, but black. Not I'm from really, really down in Africa black, but black, as in an absence of color, the content of a goth's wardrobe. Black. The room was filled to capacity, too, with Nazis. Uniform ones. Ununiform ones. All speaking German. Understandable German. You know, I've never studied a minute of German in my entire life, and whatever vocabulary I have, I picked up from watching The Great Escape, Where Eagles Dare, and Kelly's Heroes. So I'm conversing with the essentials. Gestapo. Aufmachen, for instance, or Hand of Hawk Schweinhund. But I understood everything. A quick glance at the others seemed to indicate that they were in a similar position. The roof of the room was a massive glass dome, opening to a blood-red sky, and strange contraptions that looked like offshoots from the X-Files or Military History Channel rejects streaked the sky. Walkways under the dome revealed some clusters of Nazis, some of which became ecstatic when some of the flying machines passed through, while others seemed despondent. Well, I've been in enough hockey games to figure out that the former probably picked a winner, and the others did not. Still, proficiency in Krauts is not a Kraut make, so we made a beeline for the bar, following Joe and Susan. We sat down, and our ebony cast bartender, who seemed kind of familiar, asked for our orders. I got a White Russian. Got it. Captain Joe and Dame Susan were off to our right, talking to the very same barman. I strained my ears, but only caught some of it. Some names. Action Gotterdammerung, and Sturmbahnfuhrer Malmagden, and a resuscitated casualties unit, the Totenkopf Project. This stirred memories of zombie Nazis in the Nameless Isle. I was so intent on listening in that I failed to notice a black uniformed asshole marching in. He started arguing with Dame Susan, and Captain Joe calmly stepped up. I was ready to reach for my own gun just in case the debate turned from Cold War into hot brawl. I heard Captain Joe refer to the Nazi punk as Galt. Well, that name got my attention for sure. Galt. Assassin of occultists in Cairo. Uber whatever of the Iron Army in the Dreamlands. Sorcerer extraordinaire. A dangerous man. The situation got tenser until another Nazi stepped in, or actually rolled in, to be more exact, in the shape of a decrepit, oxygen tank-supplied old man in a wheelchair, flanked by two massive Dobermans. You know, I've seen Dobermans before, and some were bigger than others, but these were bigger than any of the ones I've ever seen. Plus, they had kind of a glowing red eyes thing going on. Kind of reminded me of Ghostbusters. I didn't feel particularly happy about this. I wasn't the only one. Galt was also not happy about being called off by this guy, but acquiesced and stormed out of the door leading to the terrace with his two cronies in tow. Galt's presence gave me a jolt. All I wanted to do now was get our hands in that chronometer and get the fuck out of there. In any given bar, if you want to know something, ask the barman. All past the light banner when he addressed me by name and identified all of the others. Suffice to say that apparently the very best chronometer was in the hands of one Kurt Dorfman, who was out on the observation platform on the terrace. Well, enough said. We filed out. The terrace was quite something. It seemed to sit on a rocky spur suspended over clouds that flared red with the reflections of the crimson sky overhead. Off in the distance, the sky turned to black, pitch black without transition, as if a curtain was drawn over the sky. Some of the strange flying machines were racing ahead of the approaching darkness, and some seemed to be slower than others. The observation deck was a tower, actually, with a door guarded by a couple of uniformed thugs. Black uniform, I think. I managed to bluff my way past them, but the others had to stay below. Up on the top of the tower, Dorfman seemed engaged in bets with two other Nazi suits. Apparently the subject of the bet was whether the flying machines would make it. Bets were made, and everyone seemed quite happy. The wall of darkness closed in, but the plane stayed ahead. Then Dorfman got out a flat, circular object, slightly under 3 inches in diameter, and fiddled with it. All of a sudden, the machines came to a sudden stop, and were promptly engulfed by the darkness. Dorfman's companions seemed to take exception and were reaching for their guns. So did I, to order them off the tower, which they did. I looked damn impressive pointing a gun at your head. And after that, well, long story short, there was some chit-chat. I explained to Dorfman that I would like to have a look at his chronometer, the black wall closing in all the time. It ended up with him fiddling with the device and pulling a gun on me faster than anything I've ever seen. But he forgot one thing. It's not how fast you pull a gun. It's what you hit when you fire it. In his case, he hit nothing. In my case, I hit him. I think he may have caught a bullet from below, too. And then the bastard started to fall back, taking his device with him. I managed to catch him, barely, and wrenched the chronometer from his hands before, well, letting him go over the side. No sense in leaving evidence. The black wall was almost upon the observation deck. I gave the device a look over and punched the button marked US. Everything came to a stop. Long enough for me to rush downstairs, only to run into the bartender. Everything else and everyone else was frozen in time. He laughed, said something about this being his realm, and that the feeble powers of the chronometer could have no effect on him. Whatever. I got Frost, Chief, and Wilmot inside, where everyone else seemed to have holed up, and then punched the S button again. Time resumed its normal flow, and the wall of darkness swallowed up the terrace, but left the mansion untouched. Then the sky turned blood red again, and the terrace, and the flying machines, and the observation post, and Dorfman, all were there again, as if nothing had happened. I approached Captain Joe and Dame Susan to help us fuck the fuck off, and got us back to the point of origin. We were on a clock, So after shaking hands with our friends from OSS, I punched the MS button on the chronometer, which allowed us to get back to the gate in no time, and back to our own time, just in time. After a pat on the back, our sights were now set on upstate New York, home of homicidal maniacs in the form of the American Underground Army, custodians of a gate leading to the laboratory of Dr. Frank, and thence back into the Dreamlands. Clearinghouse for Iron Army recruits and our next nut to crack. Oshi, O'Malley, Chief, Wilmot, Frost, and myself will be flying up there this very night, while the rest, led by Lansdale, will hold the fort in New Orleans. Oh, little annex. A description of the chronometer. The chronometer is a circular flat device, around 2¾ inches across and 1/2 inch thick. It's cast from a dull, light metal. There are no seams visible. 8 buttons are located on the face of the device, labeled D, H, M, S, MS, US, NS, and P. That's from top left to bottom right. The labels indicate the passage of objective time per second of perceived time. Setting D would indicate 1 day of real time per second of subjective time, in essence slowing down time for the operator. H for hour, M for minute, S for second, neutral, MS millisecond, US microsecond, NS nanosecond, PS picosecond. According to Pliskin, the device will only operate in locations where time flow is already disrupted, which are outside normal time. Pliskin also advised that sufficiently powerful creatures are able to ignore the effects of the device. Sufficiently powerful creatures can include, without limitation, gods, extraterrestrial beings, and powerful sorcerers.